Accession number 21095, reel 22.
There I was in Bucharest, negotiating questions to be asked of President Ceausescu. And I found this a rather curious experience because it was a sort of one-person negotiation they seemed to attach huge importance to what I would ask. Anyway, it's after about 3 days, I think we were all agreed on the general gist of what I wanted to ask him, which, you know, was the usual, I think, the sort of absolute stock question about Romanian foreign policy and relationships with America, with China, what his aims were in Britain, you know, perfectly ordinary things. And finally, on the third day, I was officially informed that the meeting would take place the next morning and that I would be picked up by the chief of protocol and taken to the presidential presence and so on and so forth. And then it was midsummer and it was quite warm, and I was told, and you know, please be decently dressed and have long sleeves and wear stockings. It's quite amazing. You know, I really felt I would have to walk in backwards almost. And then I was taken sort of from one room to the next room until finally we arrived in an immense room in the presence of the great man. And I'd been told that I would be allowed about 5 minutes of sort of chit-chat with him, which I could do in French, which he could speak. And after that, I would ask my questions and he would give his answers. And I said, and what about translations? And they said, oh, no, no, you'll get our translation later. So, well, by that time I was feeling rather rebellious. And one of the things that I discovered since I'd arrived in Bucharest is that Willy Brandt was there on an official visit. So when I finally sat, you know, whatever chit-chat we had, I can't remember because, you know, he was a little man and he was as stiff as could be and there was nothing to be said, really. So we sat down, and we sat down in two armchairs standing parallel to each other with a sort of table between on which he had his papers. And, you know, I was supposed to read out my question and then he would put out his papers and read his answers, and that's what was going to happen. And at that point, I decided I was not going to obey my instructions. And I, instead of just asking the questions that had been agreed, I decided, you know, I would launch into some questions about his relationship with Germany and with Willy Brandt and this kind of thing. Well, you know, to this day, I don't know whether he understood what questions that I put, the order in which he read out his pieces of paper, but you know, this went on for about 30 minutes, and I did obviously ask some of the questions that had been agreed. And at the end of it, we shook hands and I departed, and a day later I was given the so-called translated version of the interview. And when I started looking at it, I said, look, whatever happens, this is written in such terrible English, there's no way we can print this, and in any case, you know, there just isn't enough newsy stuff in this, it'll have to be cut down severely. But there was nothing much they could do about that. They couldn't control what the Guardian would do, really. And then, before I left, I went off to see, and I discovered where Willy Brandt was staying, and I went to see him. And, we both looked at the chandeliers. It was perfectly obvious that, you know, whatever would pass between us would be recorded. And, you know, I sort of said, well, you know, how did you get on with him? He said, how did you get on with him? You know, it was I think we both said a few things that the Romanians probably wouldn't have wanted to hear. But it was rather nice catching a short, brief glimpse of him there.
This had been in his palace where you did the interview.
Yes.
What was it like?
Well, as I said, you know, I was taking in through lifts, and then we just walked, well, I mean, in his working palace, not in his living palace. And you know, you just went from one chamber to the next chamber until you arrived in this very large chamber. I must say, I was there a second time, and that was again on a visit with Geoffrey Howe. That was must have been 3 or 4 years later, and that was in the middle of the winter, and the shortages in Romania in the winter were just horrific. You know, there was virtually no light, no power, and the whole city was absolutely dark at night. I mean, there was no street lights, and some houses had heating, and some houses had gas, could cook, but very rarely the twain, even the British Embassy. And I remember there was one evening where there was a small dinner at the British Embassy, and the food had to be cooked somewhere else and brought to the embassy where they had electric light. And the hotel where we were staying had a swimming pool, and all the diplomats kept on coming to swim there because it was the only way they could wash themselves. It was just awful. But you know, Geoffrey Howe had an appointment with Ceausescu, and the journalist came with him, and we were taken from one dark, it was during the day, but you know, it was winter and sort of dark and grey skies. We were taken from one ice cold room to the next, but they gradually got warmer as we got closer to the presidential headquarters. And finally, when we arrived at Ceausescu's antechamber, everything was lit up. There was heating. And so on, and he appeared, and couldn't have remembered anything. He certainly didn't recognize me, but anyway, that was really funny that time. This business of, you know, when you saw the light and the heat, you knew we were about to be in the imperial presence. There was an incredible museum, a history museum in Bucharest, which had one floor that was given over entirely to the achievements of the Ceausescu era, and it had in it all the presents that were ever given to the Ceausescus on their various journeys, and it was full of the most incredible artifacts and medals and sashes and you name it, it was all there. And they were off. When they came to London, that was the only time I met his wife Eleanor. For one thing, she too was given, she was honored, you know, she always purported to be a scientist, and she was taken, goodness, I think to one of the scientific organizations in London, I don't remember anymore which, where again, you know, speeches were made in her honor saying, you know, what wonderful achievements the Ceausescus had behind them, and particularly she was a sort of honorable scientific record and so on. When Ceausescu came to London, I remember I was invited to a lunch at number 10, where again Jim Callaghan, the Prime Minister, made very fulsome speeches about Romania and its achievements, heaven help us, and more outgoing foreign policy and its courage in defying the Soviet Union in some respects. And I always felt all this was so misplaced, because Romania was run as a communist country. It was totally rigid in its domination of people. Dissent was simply not allowed. The secret police was everywhere. It was perfectly obvious. It was not just the foreign journalists who were meticulously followed and listened to in every possible way, but also ordinary people. I mean, it was impossible to find dissidents in Romania. And I mean, nobody ever contacted Western journalists, as far as I know. And people were cowed into submission, and I don't think that the Romanians themselves ever felt that having this independent foreign policy helped them one little bit, because all it meant was that they were even shorter of consumer goods than everywhere else, because of the links with the Soviet Union had some positive fallout as well, because even though the Soviet economy itself was hardly worth talking, I mean, the Soviet economy itself was obviously in a very poor state. But even so, I mean, there was a degree of industrialization that owed its assistance to the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. And there was a certain amount of help that came from Moscow to the communist bloc. But the Romanians were really penalized, and they were always short of fuel, partly because the Soviet Union refused to deliver enough fuel to them and tried to charge them not the Comic-Con prices, which they were charging other countries, but world prices, or at any rate higher prices. And because they were just much more limited in their access to East European markets. And the West, even though it praised Ceausescu's achievements, was not providing any kind of economic assistance to Romania. And, for instance, that hard-fought over contract for aircraft, I mean, all of this was to boost Ceausescu's ego to build up a fleet of civilian aircraft to run Tarom, which was their airline. But it did nothing for the ordinary people of Romania. And it was an extraordinary bleak country. Food was always very short. Eastern Europe, by tradition, they have street markets. But if you went to their street markets, I mean, there was very little food, very little fresh produce in it. Agriculture was clearly in a deeply depressed state. Industry was run down because they had no hard currency. There was always this huge trade in camel cigarettes, which was the sort of black market currency, which, you know, in most other countries, the cigarette trade had stopped soon after the war. In Romania, it was perpetuated, I think, right to the very end. There was very, very... I remember once the hotel, the Intercontinental, where we all had to stay, was a hotel where next to it was a theatre, and there was a fire in the theatre once, and we saw the fire engines outside, and we asked about the fire, and we were told, oh no, there hadn't been a fire, the fire engines had just been out on parade, so to speak, and they were just incapable of ever acknowledging that anything was happening, whether it was in their interests or not. And I found it I just never knew, you know, there was nothing you could write about that made any sense, because you never had any access to any information. So I, you know, sort of always wrote these rather bleak pictures of Romania, and didn't make myself very popular with them, I suppose. But, you know, I didn't care either. But I think my, you know, I don't want to labour the point too much, but I just think as a sort of postscript to Romania, I think the West was very mistaken in supporting Ceausescu for as long as it did. And I think the result of having him around so long is the corruption which has continued in Romania ever since, and which has made it virtually impossible to have any kind of democratically elected government that had a sense of purpose or knew where it was going and was trying to get away from the old traditions. And the fact that an extreme right, an extremist is now again gaining in popularity just shows how deep-seated the malaise in the country is. I have to say, during my visits, I was aware and wrote about the fact that Ceausescu was trying to increase the population of Romania as fast as he possibly could, and therefore was encouraging these endless births, and then children were thrown into these orphanages. But I was certainly not aware of the existence of this network of orphanages where children were kept in these abysmal circumstances. And I don't think that I don't recall anyone writing about that before the fall of Ceausescu. I just don't think we were aware of it. And I think although one had this sort of general impression of the bleakness of life in Romania, I don't think we realized just how awful life really was and has remained, and how difficult the transition from communism to democratic life would be, because I think Romania in many ways is the toughest of all the nuts to crack. I mean, tougher than Bulgaria. And I think people who compare the two countries today always come back to the same thing. But it was a profoundly unhappy country, and I think it was always apparent to anyone who came there.
Was it very surprising, you know, when the Ceausescus were removed and executed? Do you remember?
No. Well, I remember it. I wasn't there, but I did actually see the film of the execution quite soon after it happened, and it was extraordinary to see these two people who had seen themselves as emperor and empress in a way, suddenly just the sheer naked fear in their eyes was something to behold. But I have to say, I did not feel sorry for them. That may sound very hard, but I think, I mean, one can't say that they deserved that kind of an end, but they certainly didn't deserve that people should feel sorry for them, I think. It was obvious that in the end the resentment against them had long been suppressed, because after all, people must have had moments where they realized that they were in fact being made to lead a life where what they were being told on a daily basis bore absolutely no relationship to the life that they were actually leading. And that given the opportunity, they got at them. But of course the trouble is that having got rid of the Ceausescus, they have not rooted out the corruption that had become so endemic. I mean, you know, not just financial corruption, but every form of corruption. It's just almost impossible to stem.
They look so ordinary. When you met them, did they appear thus?
What, Ceausescu?
Yes, and his...
Yeah, well, Ceausescu was a very small man, you know. He strutted, she just looked hard and tough and cruel, and I mean that was perfectly visible from looking at them. But they were both physically quite small people, but compactly built, and clearly, you know, very attached to each other in the same way that Milosevic and his wife seemed to be attached to each other. And I'm sure in the Ceausescu's case, Eleanor Ceausescu may have been the driving force. Perhaps he would not have been quite as awful if she hadn't been there. But, you know, who will ever know just exactly who had the upper hand in that relationship? Of course, I didn't just go to Eastern Europe. I went quite frequently to the Soviet Union, usually for some specific purpose. I was very circumscribed because I don't speak Russian. I wish I'd had time to learn Russian, because I think it's a lovely language, but unfortunately there's never seems to have been the time to do it. And of course the Guardian did have, after a while started having permanent staff correspondents in Moscow, and I would sort of come as an adjunct. But I came to, I think, a couple of party congresses, and then I came on high-level visits when British foreign secretaries went, and then later I went on summits to Moscow. So this means that I usually went on special occasions rather than for any kind of routine reporting, though every time that I went, I always asked to meet officials on other aspects, not just on whether on party affairs, or if it's party congress and so on, but certainly on arms control issues, to see some of their arms experts. I always asked to see journalists, and I asked to be allowed to travel a bit outside Moscow, but again, most of that was very limited. So I can't really claim to be a Russian expert, because usually when I went there, it was to report about the wider issues of East-West relations or the arms control issues and summitry. Though, as I say, the two-party congresses, I went to cover those because at that time the Guardian didn't have a permanent staff correspondent in Moscow, and there I sort of had a big job reporting on all of that, which was, you know, quite a big responsibility, and not all that easy. But of course, they were always those were occasions where the Russians positively encouraged the foreign press to send in special correspondents. And they provided a lot of translations and interpreters and so on, and so at least one could work. On one of those occasions, I remember I was taken by American journalist friends of mine to a little session with Andrei Sakharov, which was the one time that I had a fairly close encounter with him, and understood his charisma and the this extraordinary courage that he had to stand up to the Russians in spite of all that they were trying to do to him. And then later on I used to write a great deal about him, even though from London, when he was put into internal exile to Gorky and all that, I always wrote a great deal about that. And I also met his wife, I think, on subsequent visits to Moscow. And a number of other dissidents who were well known to the Western journalists. My experience is clearly far more limited than that of people, first of all, Russian speakers, and secondly, obviously, the permanent correspondents there. One little incident that I remember well from one of my early visits to Moscow after 75, because of course I had been there before with Nixon, but excuse me. But I asked to see one of their car factories, and it was a rainy day. And when we got to the factory, and my interpreter guide parked the car that we were driving, he took off the windscreen wipers, and I said, "Why are you taking this off?" And he said, "Well, because they would be stolen." And I said, "But we're inside an automobile factory. They would be stolen." So nothing was sacred. And I learned how the foreign correspondents lived in these blocks of flats that were very tightly controlled, every coming, every going, and the flats themselves were small and uncomfortable. And I soon realized that the foreign correspondents in Moscow, their marriages, either they strengthened or they collapsed, but there was no halfway house. It was not an easy time for families. It was really a very, very tough existence. Some enjoyed it, others enjoyed it less. I think the Americans were always very comfortable there, because they were able to make more contact with dissidents than almost any other foreign journalist. They ran a lot of risks, and a lot of them got expelled as well. But I think they had very high caliber people there, the Americans, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, Time magazine and so on. And they did well, so as did the networks, the American networks. There was one particular visit to the Soviet Union that I remember with particular pleasure, and that was Gorbachev was already in power. It was a visit by a British parliamentary delegation, which was the return visit, which the delegation of the Supreme Soviet, led by Mikhail Gorbachev, had made just months before he came to power. That was the famous occasion where Mrs. Thatcher had said, "This is a man I can do business with." And Lord Whitelaw, Willie Whitelaw, and Denis Healy led the British parliamentary delegation, which returned the visits of the Supreme Soviet. And this was just the time when Gorbachev had declared a liquor-free Soviet Union. And they were not allowed to drink. And the British delegation was staying in an official government hotel where there was no drink, in Moscow, where there was no drink. And from there, the party moved to Leningrad, and again the same thing, state banquets, everything, no drink. And the next stop was Georgia, and we went to Tbilisi, and high up on the list of things for on the program for the British delegation was a visit to a winery to see how they, what sort of Georgian wines were made. And there was a wine tasting, and as you know, when wine is tasted, one sort of takes a gulp and spits it out. But in this particular case, one took a gulp and drank it, and took another gulp and drank some more wine. And it's, the wine disappeared very, very rapidly. And then the British delegation committed an even more heinous crime. They'd organized at the British consulate or British council, whatever it was, in Tbilisi, that they would host a little party. And they'd organized that scotch and gin and various other alcoholic drinks would be brought up by the British embassy for this party. And when the members of the Supreme Soviet heard of this, they decided they had to beat an early retreat to Moscow. They couldn't dignify this happening with their presence. And then there was an official Georgian dinner where they just served tiny drops of wine, just enough to sort of oil the atmosphere. But then the next day there was a farewell lunch, which was organized not at an official establishment, but at a Georgian poet's house. And the said Georgian poet was a very official person, but he was a poet, and there were toasts and toasts and toasts, and the lunch had started about 12, and by about 4 o'clock they were still toasting each other. And Willie Whitelaw came to talk to the Guardian and the Express and I don't know, and the Financial Times. I think we were the only three papers there, possibly one more. He said, if any of you write about this, you will never ever be received in any British parliamentary delegation or any context whatsoever. The fear of God was put into us not to describe this event. And then we flew back to Moscow, but not before we'd also visited a wedding palace, which I must say I absolutely adored. This was a place where Georgians got married, but depending on what they paid is what they got. And you know, we were taken through various weddings, and you know, one where we just had, you know, a plain nothing, but sort of I pronounce you man and wife, and then the next day, next one you had a choir and flower, and then you had a heavenly choir and more lilies, and it just went on and on like that. It was absolutely hilarious. But anyway, altogether, Tbilisi at that point, and then yes, there was a wonderful market in Tbilisi which was full of the most delicious things, and you know, we just felt we were in a different world. It was freer, it was Georgia. I've retained a sort of very happy memory of Georgia, and I gather today it's a very different place indeed, and rather sad, and obviously full of civil strife. But at that point, it was just relief after the disciplines of Moscow.